Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. What was once hailed as a breakthrough drug that would alleviate people's pain quickly morphed into the cause of unspeakable pain throughout America. The opioid epidemic spread was aided by the promise of relief for pain-afflicted patients and by unspeakable profits to drug companies. Physicians also played a role, some knowingly, but others merely believing the lies of pharmaceutical companies that claimed opioids were not addictive. In fact, as the new Hulu series Dope Sick illustrates, that's how OxyContin was pitched by drug reps who were warned that doctors might initially be skeptical.
All your doctors are going to be asking, how is this even possible? Your most effective talking point are these magic words.
Less than 1%.
They told me that less than 1% would become addicted.
The tragic results of that lie continue to reverberate today. In 2018, opioid drug overdoses were the leading cause of death for Americans under 50. A year later, over 70,000 Americans died from those overdoses, and more than 10 million misused prescription opioids. The COVID-19 pandemic has only served to exacerbate the problem. As I mentioned, this is dramatized in the new Hulu series Dope Sick, but that dramatization is based on the work of journalist Beth Macy and her book, Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. Her involvement began when she started documenting the impact of a heroin epidemic in Roanoke, Virginia. That led her to an investigation of opioids and her efforts to both understand how this drug took hold of unsuspecting patients and physicians and its heartbreaking impact. Beth Macy joins us for the hour to share some of what she discovered. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you here.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
And periodically throughout this conversation, we're going to hear from one of the actors in the Hulu series based on Beth's book. John Hoganacker has appeared in countless television series. Your resume is remarkably impressive. But in this particular show, he plays Randy Ramsire, I think that's how you say his name, who served as an assistant U.S. attorney during the government's case against Purdue Pharma in 2007. But you may know John Hoganacker from his work on one spectacularly popular series of TV commercials, which we'll talk about later, or from his work as a much, well, not really much, but a younger person at the Children's Theater of Charlotte. John, great to talk with you. Welcome.
It's great to be talking with you too, Mike. Thanks for having us on the show.
So you were here, you graduated from South Mech. And you performed at the Children's Theater in the 80s, and you graduated in the mid-90s. So when did you actually leave Charlotte for greener acting pastures?
I graduated in 1995 and moved to Chicago and studied theater at the theater school at DePaul University, where the most wonderful thing that has happened since moving to Chicago is I met my wife there. As part of the program, and we now have two small kids, and so we've spent 26 years in Chicago, and we're now actually back in the western part of North Carolina, very happy to say.
Well, we'll talk some more about your participation in Dope Sick and also your really successful career, because you are, if people just IMDb you, they'll be amazed at how much work you've gotten over the years. Your previous book, Beth, it's called Factory Man, and it documents the fight by Bassett Furniture, and everybody in this area knows Bassett Furniture, and their efforts to save American jobs by keeping their manufacturing in the States. And we've seen what offshoring of jobs, particularly in that industry and others like it that were centered in North Carolina, have done to the local economy and to the people who used to work in those factories. You report that the opioid epidemic, unlike the drug other drug epidemics, started not in big cities and urban areas, but in these same small towns. Do you see a connection?
Oh, totally. When I was finishing up my reporting on Factory Man, I started hearing from prosecutors and law enforcement and just regular people that I was interviewing for that book, which was largely based in Southside Virginia, Martinsville, Hickory, you know, the old furniture towns, I started hearing that crime was on a level that they had never seen before. And a lot of it was heroin. And you're like, heroin in a small town? Around the same time, that was when I started reporting on the heroin crisis back in, I had started reporting on the heroin crisis when it landed in a wealthy suburb of Roanoke, where I live in Virginia. But nobody put the two stories together, the connection between OxyContin, job losses, and then the switch when the pills got harder and more expensive to get to heroin because of dope sickness, because they have to, they're not just doing it to get high, they're doing it so they won't be in excruciating withdrawal, which they all call being dope sick. And so by 2015, the economists started to tell us that, hey, America, your life expectancy is declining for the first time in history. And largely it was because of the opioid crisis. And when you, to circle back to Factory Man, when you look at those communities and you look at the number of pills prescribed per person, those communities where the jobs went away were the places where Purdue first targeted their sales schemes. So they did it by buying data called IMS health data. And that told them which communities in America were already had doctors prescribing competing opioids. And then the executives at Purdue said, hey reps, we want you to go out and really hit those communities. And they had high rates because of, you know, workplace injuries, mining, coal, farming, that kind of thing. And so it's just very cunning and very tragic that they picked on these communities that were already hurting, such that they were rife for a pill explosion. Not just that, but also they were economically needy. And so that if you could go to your doctor and get prescribed for your bad back 30 days worth of Oxy, you could take half and sell half. And so it became a way to pay the light bill and the rent. Mm. And because it's just tragic.
I was going to ask you if obviously there's real pain that needed to be relieved. That's why they were seeking out any kind of drugs, even before OxyContin, from their doctors, because of the back-breaking work that these people had to do in mines. And even being in a mill, it can be difficult on people in those conditions. So I was wondering if it was just the back-breaking work that did it, or is it this pill that was meant to relieve pain that caused even more pain, or is it the economic pain of these jobs going off? Is how much of it was psychological pain versus physical pain that they were seeking relief
from? Yeah, I mean, that's really hard to parse out. But we know that in those areas where prescribing was the most, and that's all been documented in recent data, the Arcos data that the Washington Post and the Charleston Gazette Mail published a couple years ago, we can look at every community, and you look at those old furniture towns in North Carolina, and prescribing was huge there, and that's where the pill mills popped up. And those are exactly the same places that the so-called China effect occurred, where the jobs were offshore to China and then later Vietnam.
So talk to me about the origins of all this, of OxyContin, of Purdue Pharma, how they got to be the preeminent supplier of this opioid.
Yeah, and the show really lays that out well. So they were kind of a smallish company, family-owned. They're still family-owned by the Sackler family. You know, they were before MS Cotton, which was a continuous drug that was based on morphine that came out during the era when pain really was being undertreated for people who were dying. So MS Cotton helped people with cancer, end of life. And as the patent was about to expire, Purdue comes up with the idea of OxyContin, using the same continuous, that is, it's supposed to bleed out, one pill will bleed out over 12 hours. So really, like somebody who hasn't slept in a long time because of their pain, now they don't have to wake up in the middle of the night and take a pill. But what they did is they targeted OxyContin not only for cancer and end of life, but they targeted it for moderate pain. And not just short term. So suddenly you had kids with wisdom tooth surgery getting prescribed it, headaches, backaches, There was a story about a woman from a German Baptist family outside of Roanoke who went for TMJ pain, which is jaw pain, you know, jaw clenching, which I'm sure we all do, right? And within a month or two, she's prostituting on the streets of Roanoke. I mean, that was a story that really got me. And actually, the character, the real life character that Randy plays is the one that told me that story. I'm sorry, that John plays, Randy. But the biggest thing they did is they flipped the narrative that for 100 years we knew that opioids should only be used end-of-life cancer, very severe pain after surgery for a few days. And they said, hey, guys, it's safe. There's been this huge wave of undertreated pain. It's safe to use for all manner of things. And so a lot of people would get prescribed for, you know, a sprained thumb after a soccer game or whatever. And then the pills, because it was so massively prescribed and pushed by these reps, the leftover pills end up in America's medicine cabinets where our kids and grandkids steal them and start taking them at parties.
How much, if any, of this on the part of Purdue Pharma was innocent? In other words, did anyone within Purdue really believe that this drug was not addictive? Did they do any experimentation that led to them telling their reps to tell doctors that only 1% of the people who would take this drug would become addicted?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the show's about. It's this exciting investigative story where Rick and Randy, played by John and Peter Sarsgaard, go out to uncover how much they knew and when they knew it. And the less than 1%. I'll let John talk about that later, but that's a great moment in the show. They pleaded guilty in 2007 for criminally misbranding the drug. They pleaded guilty. The company pleaded guilty again in 2020 for fraud. So we have so many examples of them exaggerating the benefits of the drug and misstating the risks and taking no responsibility whatsoever.
Well, we have, you know, every product is in part, I think, a bill of goods. And we have to take everything that advertising says with a grain of salt if we're smart. But doctors have known about opioids forever. I mean, morphine is an opioid. Dilaudid is an opioid. We know that they're highly addictive. This is an opioid. Why would doctors believe that this drug would be substantially different in terms of its addictive qualities than any other opioid that ever prescribed down through the ages?
Well, the show lays that out so well. I mean, they sent their reps to these busy, busy doctors. Most American doctors only have had about 1 to 4 hours of training on pain management and addiction, which that's criminal. That needs to change. And so they were very, and then they would send their reps with like goodies for the receptionist and tickets to Virginia Tech baseball games or football games. Sorry, not a big sports person. What they would find out what the doctors like, and if you collected cigars, they would show up with the finest Cuban cigars. And I have a chapter in my book called Swag and Dash that outlines that. And all pharmaceutical companies were doing that, by the way, not just Purdue, but with a product as dangerous as, you know, the thing about OxyContin was it came in a higher milligram dosage than other opioids. It was really dangerous.
Beth Macy is the author. She's a journalist and the author of Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America, upon which the new Hulu limited series Dope Sick is based. John Hugenacher is also with us, who plays one of the attorneys in that series. We'll talk to him when we come back. Stay with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Dope Sick, which is soon to premiere on Hulu. It's based on Beth Macy's book, Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. She joins us from a hotel room somewhere in the heartland of Washington, D.C. Also with us is John Hugenacher. I think I said it right again. I think I just mispronounced it. I got a note from one of your producers. Out. John Hogenacker, who's an actor from Charlotte, who's in this. He plays the assistant U.S. attorney that prosecutes Purdue Pharma, and we're going to talk all about that in 2 seconds. First, the book, Dope Sick, not a novel. But you do speak with countless people in the course of reporting that book and in writing that book who directly were impacted by or involved somehow in the fight against this epidemic. And most of those people let you use their names in the book, despite the fact that some of them were addicted to this substance and all of the stuff that goes along with that. The limited TV series, however, is a dramatization. This epidemic and the government's prosecution of Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, is widely covered in newspapers, widely covered on television. Why did the producers want to use your book as the foundation for this series?
Well, that's a tricky question. Better ask to them. But
you have a good agent.
I can actually jump in and speak to that. Beth yes. did. You know, Danny, I'm going to quote Danny Strong, the show's showrunner and creator. Beth is a national treasure. The work that she's done to sort of outline how the opioid crisis came to be in our country and how it came to take hold in so many American families is so clearly laid out. That when you walk away from the book, you're just astonished that the whole thing went down the way that it did. So it serves as a necessary primer for anybody who wants to learn how we came to be where we are. So it was, I think it was an obvious choice to sort of draw from and to use in order to create a dramatic series to illustrate how we got where we are.
And Beth, as a journalist, you've been reporting on this for a long time, and you made it into a book, and you're very, as a journalist, you're very concerned about the factual nature of what you're reporting and what you're writing. But this is a fictionalized version of this story. Does it deviate from the facts a great deal, or does it simply take your facts and put them into a situation where we are compelled to watch?
Yeah, I was a little, you know, how's this going to go down? Is this going to hurt my journalistic integrity and that kind of thing? And Danny, right away, I mean, first of all, the Purdue stuff is right from the documentation. It's been heavily fact-checked, legal reviewed. And as we are working, more documents will come out all the time in these filings, like from the state of Massachusetts. The victim stories, and I have a real heart for the stories of the people, because I think my book, more than the others, covers what happens to families when this opioid addiction happens to someone you love. And, you know, I spend a lot of time with families. I've just finished writing a follow-up book to Dope Sick called Raising Lazarus, which is all about the solutions. So that's really like my heart is that, what's happening on the ground, always in all of my books. I always start with the people that are most impacted with it. But what stunned me about dramatization of even the victim stories in the show was how much we were able to put into these characters that Danny created. We would do a lot of interviews with people who are in the same situations. And then we were able to tell almost a more universal truth by not being wedded to just one person's story. We could put in details from other stories as well. So like the Phoenix character is based on somebody, a doctor Danny first heard about, but then I had a source that's in Dope Sick named Dr. Steve Lloyd, and we brought him into the writer's room, which was so cool. There were like eight of us, and we were just asking him questions that related to Dr. Phoenix's story, and he was super helpful.
So what you're saying is that the use of composite character in your book, you talk to individuals and you've taken some of their talking points and put them into the words, into the mouths of composite characters, so you can accomplish a lot more in a shorter amount of time.
Correct. Yeah. Even some of the examples from the drug users that are featured in the show are directly from stories I've heard police officers tell me or friends.
So John, you play, help me out with his last name, Randy Ramsire?
You've said it perfectly. Yeah, Randy Ramsire. He's an assistant U.S. attorney in Abingdon, Virginia.
In the Western District of Virginia, who worked on the case in 2007 against Purdue Pharma, at which he was successful. And he is not famous, despite his contributions to that story. But you had a chance to meet and talk with him. How important was that to you as an actor playing this role in this series?
It was important to me as an individual because I wanted to know that I was had contact with the person that I was going to be portraying in the show. I will say, though, that the most important bit of preparation that I did was reading Beth's book, because Randy, their office started this process of going after Purdue when their community was deeply impacted by proliferation of oxy and pill abuse in the area. Mm-hmm. They saw over time that the vast majority of violent crimes and prostitution and break-ins in the area were all tied back to drug abuse and all tied back to oxy. There's a line in the show where he talks about, you know, a few years ago, we wouldn't even lock our doors. And now all this has happened. And so Randy, along with Rick Mountcastle, who's portrayed in the series by Peter Sarsgaard, approached John Brownlee, who's portrayed in the series by Jake McDormand, who's from the Roanoke office and is the U.S. attorney, with the idea of bringing suit against Purdue. But of course, they have to then build this case, which takes a long time, years and years and years. They started in the mid to late 90s and didn't finish up until the late 2010s, the noughties actually. And that is still going on. And after they did that, they kind of started to attract more and more cases against pharmaceutical companies. And that has kind of become their sort of reason for being up there. Mm. So it was important to get to make contact with him. But honestly, a lot of the research came down to Beth's book, Dope Sick.
As I understand it, and either of you can answer this, there were many cases around the country in which plaintiffs tried and failed to pin anything on Purdue. And when the Fed started their investigation and put your character, John, Randy, in charge, you say that a fellow reporter, Beth, said that Purdue people viewed those lawyers, the two played by John and Peter Sarsgaard, as a little bit of a backwoods small town outfit, because they were from the Western District of North Carolina, but they underestimated them. Why would anybody underestimate U.S. attorneys?
Well, underestimate them at your own peril. They were working from a strip mall.
Yeah.
But they're U.S. attorneys. They're not just some local law firm wearing white suits in the summertime.
Well, I think this is part of the thing that, you know, we kind of look at in the show is how upside down the situation was. These guys are, you know, working on government salaries, and they're going after a company with an inexhaustible amount of resources. I mean, when Randy talks about going to court against Purdue, he talks about these guys flying their private jet into Abingdon, you know, with its tiny airstrip. And, you know, it would have been, it's David and Goliath, but this is the federal government trying to do what it can to make sure that you and I as Americans are protected against people who do not have our best interests at heart. And, you know, also at the core of this story and the way that this drug was able to get to the point where, you know, you can trip while you're out jogging or something and hurt your knee or your ankle and get, you know, a bottle full of oxy, is that the FDA created a label that their sales reps could then approach your doctor with and say, no, less than 1% will become addicted. So there are regulatory failures and lapses that happen all the way up the chain. And I think, you know, I think something you said earlier on, Mike, it's kind of like buyer beware. And we as consumers, and we don't like to think of ourselves as consumers when we go to the doctor's office, but that's kind of the way our country is set up. We have to be aware of the risks of the things that we put into our bodies. And, you know, we are geared to trust one another when we're face to face, and certainly to trust our healthcare providers. Peter has talked at great length in the press that we've done about the role of the caregiver and the healer in society, and how we've sort of lost our connection to that. So I think you had a lot of doctors who genuinely wanted to provide care and solutions for the people in their care. And because of regulatory failures at the FDA level, were sort of tricked into doing it with Oxy.
I have not seen the series because I haven't been given any tape on it, but I did see some clips from it. And in one of the clips, the doctor that you referred to, Beth, played by Michael Keaton, who unwittingly becomes involved in prescribing these drugs, I think he's a school doctor, at one point says, and I'm going to paraphrase here, "I thought I was helping my patients. I can't believe how many of them are dead because of what I did." Did that character come from interviews in the book? Did that character come from, did those words come out of the mouth of the doctor that you brought into the writer's room?
You know, I can't answer that, but definitely he shared that sentiment with us. I'm not sure if it was word for word. He talked about, you know, all the pressure. He talked about the reps that would visit his office. And then he talked about just like the pain of having to live with what he did and some of his patients who died. And I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but he suffers greatly because of OxyContin. And he shared a lot with us about that.
I actually thought about this yesterday as I was watching that clip. That these are all small. A lot of this you focus on small towns. It's happened all over America, but you focused on small towns. And if you're the doctor in a small town, a school doctor who has prescribed these drugs and it's led to the deaths of lots of people in your small town, how do you stay? How do you continue to live? How do you continue to practice medicine in that small town? Even though you didn't do this deliberately, it just happened. How do you stay? What does that do to your life?
Yeah, right. And you see that playing out with Michael Keaton's character. Like, he's really wrestling with that and wrestles with the guilt. And these are people, kids he's delivered, you know, and the way he stays. And so one of the activists that I profiled in Dope Sick, she's married to a real life small town doctor named Dr. Art Van Zee. And he's also his character, his person is played in the show. He's not just a character, but he was one of the first doctors in America to fight back and call Purdue up. And this is how I got on the story, because he's in my region that I report from, and to say, look, I know it says less than 1% get addicted, but I've got longtime patients, kids I deliver, overdosing in the high school library. This is late 1999 and 2000. Please take your drug off the market and reformulate it to be abuse resistant. So you also have real people in the show and real people in real life who tried to alert the public, but because they were from Appalachia and from rural America, they got kind of discounted. And, you know, Purdue thought they could just buy them off, but they couldn't buy them off.
And it isn't just the fact that doctors are prescribing or were prescribing this drug and misprescribing it, overprescribing it, people finding a way to trick the system into giving them more than they were originally prescribed. It isn't just that. It's the fact that they would get more, and some of these pills would make their way to the street. And on the street, people discovered how to manipulate the actual pill so that they could take it in a stronger form. That's when it became a street drug. How did street dealers become involved in the dissemination of this drug?
Oh, almost immediately. One of the cops in a town very much like our fictional town out in Lee County, Virginia, which is in the western part of the state, said, you know, had a com. I tell this story in Dope Sick. Confidential informant, longtime person, leans into the car and they say, there's this new drug they got up here. So this fella's selling, it's called OxyContin. And he says, it's great, you know? And so what that police officer told me was, you'd see people just walking around and they would have these orange and green stains on their shirt sleeves. And that was from putting the 40 or the 80 in their mouth letting that time release coating melt off like an M&M, and then they would brush the coating off, and then they would crush it up and snort it or inject it. And that was almost immediately. And so when Dr. Van Zee in Dope Sick, the book, starts calling Purdue and telling them that this is happening, he very, you know, just honestly, naively, whatever you want to call it, thinks they actually care about it and want to do something about it, but they don't.
And of course not. Anne on Facebook writes, why are dentists still prescribing opioids to teenagers after having their wisdom teeth removed? This happened with my 17-year-old son just 4 months ago, and as his mother, I absolutely refused the prescription to be filled. Why are they still prescribing it?
That's a great point, Mike. And I want to just say the same thing happened to Peter very recently. He recently had, Peter Sarsgaard, who plays Rick, recently had his wisdom teeth out, and he was in there with his dentist, and the dentist said, I'm going to give you some painkillers, but I'm also going to give you some fun stuff just in case the pain gets bad. So I think there's a sort of cavalier approach to the power that these drugs have that's sort of throughout our society. And I think that this epidemic has affected a lot more Americans than we're actually openly talking about and openly discussing. And I think this is the other thing that Purdue sort of created and spent a lot of time and resource on, was creating a narrative that would malign people who would become addicted to a synthetic version of opium. They did that on purpose, so that when you and I talk on the street and you say, oh, did you hear Bob got addicted to OxyContin? Our sort of immediate reaction is, based on the news we've read, well, Bob probably was an addict to begin with and would have become addicted to something else. What you find out in Beth's reporting and in the book and in the TV show is that that is a narrative that has been created and crafted and fed to us so that the pharmaceutical companies can continue selling this drug to anyone and everyone.
So they're like big tobacco in a way. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more. I want to talk specifically about your character, Randy, the U.S. assistant, the U.S. attorney who helped prosecute this and break this case open in the Western District of Virginia in just a couple of seconds. John Hoganacker is with us. He's an actor in the series Dope Sick on Hulu, and Beth Macy is the author of the book upon which the series is based. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with John Hoganacker, who plays Randy Ramsar. I'm so sorry, Randy. I'm name challenged.
You're in a briar patch.
Okay. He plays Randy Ramsire, who is the assistant U.S. attorney who helped prosecute the Dope Sick case, well, the OxyContin case against Purdue Pharma, which is laid out in the Hulu series Dope Sick, based on Dope Sick, the book by Beth Macy, which is a work of journalism, not fiction by any stretch of the imagination. But you wrote the book. You were in the writer's room, Beth. I'm told that you wrote two of the episodes. You're not a fiction writer. You don't write dialogue. What was that experience like?
Oh, well, I co-wrote them, which means I took a stab at half of both of those, and Danny fixed them. Danny fixed my first stab. I got better by the seventh episode, the second one I co-wrote. I think some of my lines actually made it into the final script, but it was super fun. I mean, Danny is... I tell people it's like getting a master class on screenplay writing. The trickiest thing is I no longer had that tool of being able to digress and to bring in the history of opium and why there is this revolving door between the FDA and industry and how that came to pass. And so we have to figure out a way to get those things into dialogue or, you know, through drama. And that was just hard for me to get my head around at first.
Before I talk to John about his character and how he built that character and the function of the character in Hulu's Dope Sick, talk to me about which was the bigger problem, the prescription drugs that were being prescribed by doctors in perhaps who didn't understand their addictive nature and people getting more and more of them as prescriptions, or what happened on the street when people learned how to dissolve the time release coating and get that, as you say, that little pearl of pure oxycodone, which could then be crushed and snorted, mixed with water and injected, etc. Which was the bigger problem in America?
Well, I think none of it would have happened without this overprescription epidemic that happened because of this marketing blitz, right? And because the thing with opioid use disorder is once it's got your opioid receptors in its clutches, I mean, you're hooked and you have to have that or you'll be dope sick, which every person that I talk to says is like the worst flu times 100. It's diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, crushing anxiety and depression. And it's almost like they have this outsized fear. They technically can't die from opioid withdrawal, but it's just, it becomes this overriding urge to have to have it. And without Purdue, you know, creating this overprescription epidemic, we would have never had a heroin epidemic, would have never had a fentanyl epidemic. This was, as the New York AG Letitia James said, the taproot of the epidemic is OxyContin.
And this plays into a conversation we had earlier this month with a neuroscientist who says that we are geared to search for pleasure in our brains, but that the search for pleasure always leads to pain, interestingly enough, because the body's trying to get back to stasis. Law enforcement has long gone after street drug pushers. This was a case in which law enforcement and the justice system went after a legitimate pharmaceutical company, and it took years to prosecute, John. Had anything like this case been prosecuted before, and what challenges, because you did a lot of research into your character and you spoke to him, the man you actually play, what challenges did that pose for federal authorities and for prosecutors?
Well, again, you know, we think about the Department of Justice as this big marble building on a hill fighting the good fight for all of us. But the reality is all of the district offices don't have all of the resources to actually fight the big guys. I've asked Beth this question. How many, it was, I think in the show, Beth, we talk about there had been something like 65
cases
against Purdue before these guys even brought suit, and they had all failed.
Yeah, 65-0. Howard Udell would brag in the press releases, not one has gone to a trial because they would settle them and then bury them with their private jet flying lawyers.
So this, like Mike, this is like, yeah.
Sorry. This suit could have been brought anywhere in America, and this is why Rick and Randy deserve lauding, because a couple of lawyers, a couple public servants working from a strip mall in a tiny town in Southwest Virginia brought this case. No other U.S. attorney in the nation had the nerve to do it.
Well, let me talk about that for a second, because Randy Ramsire, the person you're playing in Dope Sick, told the Wilmington News Journal that, quote, in terms of money, this was the biggest case I had been involved with up until that point. He's since gone on to prosecute other pharmaceutical companies for other possible offenses. So do you play him as a crusader or as a serious attorney working in uncharted waters, plodding through a complicated case with an uncertain outcome? How do you play him?
Well, the take on Randy as he arrived on the page was that he was sort of a jovial guy who, I think he's actually a native of Ohio, who ended up in Abington in his early, I want to say in his 20s. And he's sort of portrayed as kind of a country lawyer, very easy to get along with, laid back. My touchstone was Matlock. You know, I thought of him as a guy who's like disarms people with his kindness and his sort of jovial nature. But that belies a really, really sharp intellect and a desire to set the record straight and a desire to address these sort of lies that have been spread around by Goliath, in this case, Purdue Pharma. We did not know, obviously, at the beginning of our journey, what the outcome was going to be. Randy and Rick didn't know. But over the course of time, with all of the work that Purdue put into sort of blocking us at every, there's a point in the film where we get Purdue to give us their records. And as you can imagine, something like 5 or 6 moving trucks pull up out front of our strip mall, and we have to go through all of that. We just don't have the resources. We don't even have scanners at this point. It's going to take us years.
Right.
But I think that the fun part about getting to play Randy in this situation is the sort of counterpoint between him and Rick, as portrayed by Peter, which is he's set up as a very sort of straight arrow, never smiles. His focus is even more laser than Randy's, and two of them together sort of provide this great balance. Peter and I go back and forth throughout.
So Peter Sarsgaard is your legal eagle partner in this in Dope Sick, and here's what Rolling Stone has to say about how your characters contribute to the story. Perhaps you've read this already, I don't know, but I'm reading it to you. The pair is used to identify all the ways that Purdue managed to manipulate both federal regulators and the American medical establishment to put this intense addictive drug into the medicine cabinets of people suffering from pain that was mild at worst. There's a chilling scene where Randy, your character, winds up in the hospital for an unrelated medical issue, and his doctor and nurses keep trying to talk him into taking OxyContin despite his repeated protests. And Rolling Stone says that yours are among the miniseries' best scenes. Any reaction to that?
Well, you know, as an actor, we have to, if we give weight to the good reviews, we also That's have right. to give weight to the bad reviews. So I think for me personally, I want to approach every opportunity to get to tell a story with the intention of bringing to life a fully fleshed out human being. I don't think it's interesting to, you know, if I'm playing someone we would call a villain or a bad guy, to give you sort of a black and white caricature yeah. of a villain.
Plus villains don't think of themselves as being villains.
Absolutely not. They have the same amount of love for themselves as the good guys would have for themselves. Right. And I think that is a much more interesting portrayal to watch. And I think, I digress here, but I think the Sacklers, especially as portrayed by Michael Stuhlbarg in this show, is fascinating to watch, because you see a guy who, and he's one of the Sacklers. He's one of the guys that we're saying is doing bad things. You see at the center of his journey, like a family drama. He wants to prove himself to his family. Yeah. You see a guy sort of pushing back against this idea that he's never been good enough, or he's never really proven himself. And his portrayal is just fantastic and very fun to watch. I was just going to say, Randy wanted to say when we talked via Zoom, we first met, he was like, I just want you to know, I'm not like a hero. We're not perfect. We messed things up. We didn't get it right. We yelled at each other. We were angry. And I think that made it into the show, too.
You've been, as I said at the very beginning of this, John, you've been in a lot of TV series. I think the most recent one prior to this was Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan, which I watched every episode of on Amazon Prime. In Dope Sick, you're working with Michael Keaton and Peter Sarsgaard and others, and you have equal billing to those people. What's that feel like to a kid from South Mecklenburg High School who performed at Children's Theater of Charlotte? What's that feel like? Was that ever in your mind's eye when you decided this was the career path you were going to take?
You know, my dad, Jerry Hoganacker in Charlotte, he did theater at the Little Theater back in the day. And he also did a lot of commercials and voiceover in town. And I think I always saw how much fun he had doing that, and I wanted to do it as well. As far as working with Michael and with Peter and with Rosario and Will Poulter and all these amazing, and Caitlin Deaver, all these amazing people who were involved in the show, I have admired their work. And, you know, when I get to work with them, when we work together and I meet them, I always start by kind of saying, thank you for making yourself vulnerable and putting yourself out there, because that is genuinely the hardest part of what we get to do. And I think we all have a lot of gratitude and humility for the opportunity to get to do it every time we are given the opportunity. Peter and I just had, you know, despite the heavy subject matter, and I think this is often the case with actors, the darker the subject matter, the more shenanigans and goofing around you have backstage, because you have to, you talk about stasis, you have to bring balance to a project. So Peter and I, you know, we spent a lot of time hanging out, having fun. We went on a lot of hikes through the Frisbee a lot in Richmond, around the Richmond area. It was a wonderful experience. And, you know, getting to work with Danny and with Beth, I think you're, as I said before, you're always grateful when you get to be involved in a cool project and to tell a story. But when you get to be involved in something that is actually important in society, it is, I feel deeply fortunate to have been involved with this.
Actors,
as a young guy from South Mac or wherever.
Yeah, well, actors take a lot of roles. Actors want to work, and they take roles that they need to take in some cases. Sometimes they take roles because it means it's meaningful to them personally. Sometimes they take a role because it's going to be good for their pocketbook or their careers or whatever. And for people who are not watching us on Facebook, who may be listening to your voice but not recognizing your face, they might recognize you more from something that you did for just a nanosecond in time, but put you on the map. And that was that series of commercials for Bud Light and the catchphrase that you utter repeatedly in that commercial, "Dilly Dilly." Let's listen to that performance.
Madam Susan, you are an even truer friend of the crown. Dilly Dilly.
Dilly Dilly.
What is that?
This is a spiced honey mead wine that I have really been into lately. So, dilly dilly, right?
Please follow Sir Brad. He's going to give you a private tour of the Pit of Misery.
I'm sorry, what?
Pit of Misery, dilly dilly.
Dilly dilly.
So, what, if anything, did that do for your career?
You know, it's bizarre, Mike. I'll tell you a funny story. So I was walking down the street in Chicago at, you know, kind of when all of that was going on. So we did that first spot in New York, and then we did another one in New York a couple months later. And then we went to New Zealand to film spots for the Super Bowl. And then we went to Spain a bunch of times. It was really, really a fun experience. And as far as doing commercial work as an actor, I think it was about as cool as it could possibly get. Although that director, Jim Jenkins, and I recently did a spot for Chevy out in Utah with a cat that can fetch and do all this other stuff for Chevy Silverado. That was Walter the cat, in case anybody's listening. A lot of fun during the Olympics on that. But we never knew when we were doing that first spot that it was going to become this big thing. Anyway, so we're in the midst of this like 2 or 3 year period that was going on. And I was walking down the street in Chicago, and generally was kind of like, I want to make sure people know that I do. Like, I played Hamlet in 2004 at the Illinois Shakespeare. Does anybody know that? No, nobody knows that.
Of course not.
So anyway, I'm walking down the street, and I see this guy coming up the sidewalk towards me, and he's got a sweatshirt on that says Dilly Dilly. And I think, well, you know what? I'm feeling magnanimous today. I'm going to make this young man's day. So I kind of lean over in front of him as he's walking the other way, and I say, I like that sweatshirt. And I smile, you know, and give him the full face. And he kind of is like, thanks, dude. And he just kept walking.
Isn't that great?
Clearly just freaked another guy out for no reason. He went home and told his wife, this
didn't
rando
recognize
just kind of in my face.
To dilly or not to dilly? That is the question. John Hoganacker, our guest, he plays Randy Ramsire, the assistant U.S. attorney in Dope Sick on Hulu on October the 13th. Beth Macy is the author of the book, Dope Sick. Thank you both for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.